Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the Florida legacy of guitarist Duane Allman.
His list of accomplishments is just absolutely remarkable. It's astounding, and his career was mostly in about a three-year span.
We'll discuss Fort Myers and the Civil War.
The reoccupation of the fort by U.S. military in 1864 proved to be a considerable irritant to Florida Confederates on several levels.
And we'll talk about the El Destino Plantation Papers. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Rolling Stone magazine has called Duane Allman the second greatest guitarist of all time, behind only Jimi Hendrix. Duane Allman learned to play guitar while growing up in Daytona Beach, formed his band the Allman Brothers in Jacksonville, and recorded an important rock album with Eric Clapton in Miami. Holly Baker has this look at Duane Allman.
Public historian and musician Bob Beatty is the author of the book Play All Night, Duane Allman and the Journey to Fillmore East. Duane Allman, considered to be one of the greatest guitarists of all time, was just 10 years old when his family moved to Florida from Nashville. While living in Daytona Beach, Duane and his younger brother Greg became immersed in music.
Duane and Greg both were listening a lot to the radio, a lot to WLAC here out in Nashville, 50,000-watt station that honestly got all the way down to Jamaica because Bob Marley was listening to it and was inspired with the Wailers and their early singing. And Bob Dylan, all the way up in Hibbing, Minnesota, was listening WLAC. And that is rhythm and blues music, black music. Jimmy Reed, blues guitarist, probably one of Duane's earliest influences. B.B. King, the king of the blues. He later finds Elmore James as a slide guitarist. And contemporaries at this point in the mid-60s and up, you got Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck. Probably not as much Jimmy Page. That's like that triumvirate everybody says. Mike Bloomfield is a huge influence on Duane. And I should say, Greg sort of gravitates towards the singers. Little Milton Campbell is his big influence. They all loved Ray Charles. What I'd say is one of the first tracks they recorded.
See the girl with the diamond ring.
Like I said, this is that whole generation of rhythm and bluesers who are listening to that stuff. He doesn't pick up slide, which is kind of the thing he gets most well known for in his lifetime until 68-ish.
Before they formed the Allman Joys and eventually the Allman Brothers Band, they played in an integrated band in Daytona Beach called the Escorts that regularly performed at the Daytona Beach Pier and even opened for the Beach Boys in 1965.
Early on, it's very evident that they gravitated toward black music, as did, by the way, almost all the players in this story. African American music is the bedrock of Southern rock. It's the bedrock of rock and roll. It's really the bedrock of American music. It all sort of bubbles up from jazz in these different ways. Jazz is playing how you want to play at that moment, right? So they form these garage bands and record some and are in some local competitions. And one of those, yes, is an integrated band. They played on the white side of town at the Daytona Beach Pier. And then afterwards, they would go to the black side of town and play. And some of the only, actually, Dwayne and his contemporaries were some of the only folks who were okay on the black side of town, or at least accepted. The factors that work out for Dwayne and Greg are mostly because they're just determined not to fail. You know what I mean? I mean, the South doesn't offer them a lot. Florida doesn't offer them a lot. They record as the Escorts in Daytona Beach. They hit the road as the Almond Joys as soon as Greg finishes high school and go up to Nashville. They were very famous for always being beyond what anybody else was doing because of how complex they were, but they weren't succeeding. Records weren't selling. They later go to New York with the Sandpipers, and that doesn't go well. Then they go crazy and go all the way out to LA, and that just about kills them all. And that's where that determination says, we got to come back home and do it our way. Or I have to. Starts with Dwayne.
Hey, Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her in your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey, Jude, don't be afraid.
After working in Muscle Shoals, Alabama as a session guitarist on Wilson Pickett's acclaimed Hey Jude album, Dwayne Allman returned home to Florida. In March of 1969, during an impromptu jam session in an old gray house at 2844 Riverside Avenue in Jacksonville, he formed the Allman Brothers Band with his brother Greg, Dickie Betts, Barry Oakley, Butch Trucks, and J-Mo Johansson.
I've always been intrigued by Dwayne's excellence, by his excellence in an ensemble rather than individual excellence within an ensemble. Those are things that really appeal to me as a human being. They appeal to me as a musician. They appeal to me as a fan. His list of accomplishments is just absolutely remarkable. It's astounding. And his career was mostly in about a three-year span. And here's the thing I always find really remarkable about him. He kept grinding because he had something that he wanted to do and say. He had a choice to do anything he wanted to by the time he had that contract in early 69. Dwayne could have formed a group, the Dwayne Allman Experience, like the Jimi Hendrix Experience, right? Dwayne could have done just about anything he wanted to. And what his choice was to put together a band of equals. He subsumed his own ego and his tremendous talent because he understood his talent was best unleashed in an ensemble and in one where he was a part of the whole. Holly, I think that's absolutely remarkable. And the reason I do, again, is he had an ego. He knew how good he was. He did. But almost everything I've seen says he was a really kind and generous spirit about that. And it says a lot to me that his choice was to pull five other guys together to do this ensemble thing where even when he wasn't soloing, he was still a major part of the story because he was playing rhythm or pushing things, or you'll hear him pushing Greg or pushing the drums or something, or the vice versa, while Dickie Betts is wailing on a solo. I've got this idea in my mind about leadership lessons from Dwayne Allman, because I've been doing museums and leadership and all that for most of my life, most of my professional career. And so I've got that, and that's one of those lessons, right? Like, subsume yourself a little bit for the greater good and listen to what comes of it.
In the summer of 1970, Dwayne Allman was offered an opportunity to collaborate on a musical project with one of his heroes. Eric Clapton and his band Derek and the Dominoes were in Miami recording an album at Criteria Studios. Clapton invited Dwayne Allman to Criteria, and he ended up playing lead and slide guitar on 11 of the 14 songs. That album, called Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs, is best known for its title track, Layla, a song Eric Clapton wrote about his unrequited love for Patti Boyd, the wife of his friend George Harrison of the Beatles. Dwayne Allman improvised his guitar riff in Layla and transformed a song that was meant to be a slow love ballad into a bluesy rock song.
Nobody's waiting.
think most people would say Eric Clapton's peak was Layla. Dwayne is all over it. And pretty much everybody says Dwayne is the reason that record is sublime versus just great or something like that.
It was also a defining moment for Dwayne Allman. In March of 1971, the Allman Brothers Band recorded their only live album in New York City. At Fillmore East would go on to be considered one of the best live albums of all time. Bob Beattie.
I'm a fan of live albums. Many live albums are cleaned up considerably in post-production. At Fillmore East is a completely live record. I think that's astounding. That is like 78 minutes of playing on the absolute edge. And I aspire to that. I aspire to that kind of greatness. I am drawn to it, everything else. Dwayne Allman, when it was all on the line for him and his band, they were going to break it up. They'd had two unsuccessful records. They were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars staying on the road. They were picking up fans, but there wasn't no money coming in. And then they said, what are we going to do? We're going to go and record on the biggest, most important stage of our generation. And we're going to do it all live. And then we're going to put out a record that way. So what was their artistic statement, right? Their artistic statement was a couple short blues tracks, really wailing on the slide, show off Greg's voice. A really great slow blues, Stormy Monday, a Bobby Blue Bland song that most of the bands of that generation would play some version of that slow blues or something like that. We're going to throw in some real jams. We're going to do You Don't Love Me, a Junior Wells song that we're going to take it to 19 minutes. We're going to play some instrumentals and, you know, in Liz Reed and Hotlanta. And then we're going to close it with Whipping Post, this 22-minute song written in Jacksonville at the Gray House up there at 2844 Riverside Avenue. So they basically put it all on the line for their art. So they curated this record. What a lot of people will say when I'll talk to them is they call it the Fillmore concerts or the live at the Fillmore. It was four concerts they recorded. Most of them come from the two nights on Saturday, majority of them the latter show on Saturday. And they chose this, right? They didn't just go up there and say, we're going to throw a bunch of notes and throw a record out. We are going to curate this document.
The album At Fillmore East became an instant success and earned a gold record in 1971. It seemed as if the Allman Brothers Band was destined for stardom. But a few months after the album's release, Dwayne Allman died in a motorcycle accident in Macon, Georgia. He was only 24 years old. Even though his remarkable career only lasted a few short years, he is remembered as one of the greatest guitarists of all time. In 1995, Dwayne Allman was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as the founder of the Allman Brothers Band, the first Southern rock band.
The Allman Brothers are the first Southern band to play rock music to break out of the South. Therefore, they are a Southern, rock band, right? Or a rock band from the South. The record industry, particularly Capricorn Records, the Allman Brothers label, grasps onto this term Southern rock, which in the book I use a capital S, lowercase r, to denote a musical genre that is very loosely defined of a bunch of boogie rock bands with some country influence who stayed in the South, who didn't hide their Southernness. The Allman Brothers invented it, if you will, because they gave other Southern musicians a chance to stay in the South and make their music, Southern inflected music, without trying to water that down at all. They were a band that broke out of the South as a band. So a lot of Southerners left the South. Floridians, Graham Parsons, Tom Petty, the two dudes from the Eagles, Bernie Ledden and his brother Tom with Mudcrutch later, and Don Felder, Stephen Stills. They all leave the South to make it. The Allman Brothers tried three different times. Dwayne and Greg tried and failed three different times until Dwayne said, screw it, we're staying in the South and we're going to do this. So that makes them the Southern rock band, except their sound is nothing like what comes after it.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, as the third state to secede, Florida was an eager supporter of the Confederacy and contributed a number of men to the Southern Army, but it was not the site of many major battles.
That's correct, but Florida did play an important role in the Civil War, especially after the U.S. cut off access to the cattle-raising regions of the Trans-Mississippi. Late in the war, as the movement of cattle from Florida to Georgia became critical to feeding Southern troops, Florida's importance rose. Union strategists hoped to cut off access to beef by focusing on two areas, one in the northern part of the peninsula and one in the southwestern region. The Southwestern Initiative centered on Fort Myers, a Seminole War installation that had been abandoned in 1858. As Irvin D. Solomon in his 1993 article, Southern Extremities, The Significance of Fort Myers in the Civil War, argued, the reoccupation of the fort by U.S. military in 1864 proved to be a considerable irritant to Florida Confederates on several levels. First, although Confederates had become accustomed to the federal embargo and its enforcement by the Union East Gulf blockading squadron, as well as the periodic raids along the West Coast, they were less willing to tolerate a permanent federal post in South Florida. They understood that the presence of the U.S. soldiers represented a serious threat to the cattlemen supplying the Confederate armies. Finally, and perhaps equally important, the Union commanders decided to staff the fort with soldiers from the U.S. colored troops.
By 1864, South Florida, like many parts of the Confederacy, was awash with competing views on the war, and loyalties were not as clear-cut as they had been 3 years earlier.
That's right. Many South Floridians were willing to serve in the Home Guard, but resisted conscription to fight in Georgia and Virginia. Indeed, Solomon notes that General P.G.T. Beauregard, commander of the military department in South Florida, and Florida Governor John Milton issued conditional pardons to those who had evaded conscript officers in the hopes of wooing them back to the cause. So you had the U.S. military seeing an opportunity to cut off the food supply to the Confederate Army, a small Confederate military presence determined to protect the supply lines, and a large group of farmers and cattlemen vacillating between the two forces. Finally, there were those black soldiers, the Confederates' worst nightmare, armed blacks in the very heart of South Florida. Solomon reports that Union commanders, quote, often vacillated on the issue of emancipation, but the presence of black troops encouraged self-emancipation by area slaves. As one Confederate observer noted, events changed after the placement of U.S. colored troops at Fort Myers. Quote, it was a war for possession of this country. The federal troops, mostly Negroes, made a move to go through the country to burn, destroy, and capture everything from Fort Myers, end quote.
Connie, this conflict between opposing armies over production and movement of cattle transformed into a larger ideological and cultural conflict, right?
Indeed it did, and it often pitted people against one another on the same side. The presence of the Union Army encouraged refugees to seek safety in the fort, but Unionists were frequently appalled by the presence of black troops, who also tried to protect men and women escaping slavery. In what quickly became overcrowded conditions, the tensions were high at Fort Myers. For their part, the Confederates created the Florida Special Cavalry, or Cow Cavalry, to, quote, repulse the now frequent Union forays, protect Confederate cattle herds, and stem the rising tide of desertion, end quote. Things came to a head in the winter of 1865, when the Confederates, under the command of Major William Footman and a force of 275 men, marched out of Tampa, planning a surprise attack in the late evening or early morning. On February 20, 1865, the Confederate forces confronted the troops at Fort Myers. Although the Confederates had the troops and armament superiority, they withdrew after 11 hours and returned to Fort Meade. An eyewitness reporter from the New York Times wrote that, quote, the colored troops were in the thickest of the bite. Their impetuosity could hardly be restrained. They seemed totally unconscious of danger, or regardless of it, and their constant cry was to get at them, unquote. On March 14, 1865, the U.S. Army completed a planned withdrawal from Fort Myers, providing the Confederates with reason to claim victory long after they left the field of battle. While Solomon recognizes the engagement at Fort Myers did not change the outcome of the war or even count as one of the more memorable battles, the history of Fort Myers, quote, affirmed the Union's ability to disrupt Confederate activity throughout South Florida's interior, confirming the validity of the federal strategy of blockading the coast, raiding the hinterland, and interdicting the critical cattle trade in South Florida, contributing to the decline of the Confederacy and its ultimate defeat, end quote.
An often overlooked part of the Civil War in Florida. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is professor of history at the University of Central Florida, director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. El Destino Plantation was established in 1828 and continued operation well into the 20th century. Sebastian Garcia explains the significance of the El Destino papers housed at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
From consulting with families on how to do family histories to overseeing transcriptions done by volunteers that are essential to her projects. I spoke with Pat during this year's Florida Historical Society Public History Forum in Lakeland about her latest project, the El Destino Papers, a collaboration between FHS and FSGS to preserve and make accessible unique Florida plantation documents. As the United States South kept expanding its borders during the 19th century, many wealthy white men migrated into these areas, and with them, their plantations and the institution of slavery. Florida was no exception, as it became an official U.S. territory in 1821, and slave owners were quick to capitalize on this newly acquired land. El Destino was one of many Florida plantations formed during this time period.
It was started in 1828 by a man from Virginia who wanted to cash in on the Florida land boom, and he sent his sons down to clear the land and sent a group of 28 along with him. Through the years, the plantation grew, and as he married, his wife brought in more land and slaves she inherited, and the property grew. At its heyday, El Destino was about 4,500 acres, and there were maybe 140 workers on El Destino.
As Pat explained to me, this project was initially under the Florida Pioneer Project, and the El Destino's papers specifically were brought to her by former FHS archivist and assistant producer of Florida Frontiers Radio, Ben DiBiase. However, the project took a life of its own once Pat and her team found a pleasant surprise.
It was obvious those records were important, whether Ben used them or not, that they needed to be there. Once we got into them, I mean, they were described as plantation records and business documents and some journals, but once we got in there and found lists of enslaved people by name and how old they were, and in family groups. They came alive. And it was something we had to work with and we had to share with their descendants. And putting it into the information, into family trees, and documenting all of it, just, it was a no-brainer.
Besides the usual aspects plantation records hold, what it grew, how many products it produced, correspondences, ledgers, etc., what makes the El Destino Papers a, quote, unique Florida plantation document, end quote, is a list of enslaved people by name, how old they were, and what family groups they were in. From there, the purpose and significance of the project became apparent.
No purpose other than identifying the enslaved peoples. It's so hard for Black families to trace their ancestors back before 1870. That was the first U.S. census that listed people by name. There were slave schedules in 1850 and 1860, but they simply listed male or female and the age. And you can't tell if that's your person or not.
When I asked what she thinks the legacy of the El Destino plantation is, she firmly responded with,
"It's the fact that there are records still existing. So many of those records just were destroyed. There just aren't very many records from that era. I mean, we're talking about almost 200 years ago. And to find any of them still around and in such good shape, they're not particularly faded. The paper's not discolored. It was a revelation to me that they had legal pads in the 1860s. But the records are just in such good shape, it's a shame not to use them."
I found it compelling when during her panel presentation at the FHS Public History Forum, she declared that this El Destino Papers project is the most satisfying project she's ever done. Given her extensive career doing family searches and genealogical research projects, I had to ask her why.
Because it lets people who are having such a difficulty pulling their family histories together, it lets them go through that curtain of slavery and get back into where their families were and when. To know that it was on this piece of property, just right outside of Tallahassee, as opposed to somewhere in Georgia or Alabama or something like that, it just must be a tremendous sense of satisfaction for these Black families to know where they came from.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, graduate history student and history podcast producer for the Department of History at the University of Central Florida.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. And until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester, Holly Baker, and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.